You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to a very famous lullaby, Rockabye Baby. This lullaby may have seemed like it's been around forever, but how long have lullabies really been around?
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share a new theory on how lullabies evolved. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us every month to share the latest and coolest news in science. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello and happy science.
So lullabies, infant directed songs, I think scientists call them. I like the sound of that better. Where do lullabies come from?
Well, that is the great question. And, you know, this one team earlier this year came out with actually the first formal theory. If you can believe it, it's taken this long to even get our first formal theory. But basically, lullabies arose out of an arms race.
That doesn't sound very warm and nurturing, Gemma, with arms race between who? The infants and the moms, right?
Yeah, the moms who were their traditional caregivers. And it all goes back to that period when humans and our human ancestors were really becoming fully bipedal. Just to be fully bipedal, pelvic changes happened. The bones narrowed. It limited the size of the infant at the time of the birth. So humans, all of us, are kind of born in a state of prematurity, believe it or not. But if you think about other animals like horses and cows, right after they're born, they're up and walking. But humans need this extended period of really hands-on care after birth when they're babies. So basically, you've got the baby, you've got the mom, again, the traditional caregiver, and you've also got predators, the need to find shelter, the need to find food, the need to take care of other babies and children you may have running around. So basically, the mother, even though the baby still needs the care, the mother at some point has to put the baby down and deal with some of the other things she's got going on in her life. I'm sure moms can today still relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you have to design something. Something has to evolve. Let's put it that way. Something has to evolve that the mother, traditional caregiver, can reassure the baby, yes, I'm really paying attention to you, even though I'm not holding you at this instant. And the baby, as young and, you know, not exactly cognitively advanced as it is, it needs to be able to gauge the authenticity of that attention. Are you really paying attention to me or what? And that's basically how lullabies evolved. You can, you know, make a noise that the baby will appreciate as, okay, that noise means you're paying attention to me. But the more complex the noise you make, the more sure that baby is, okay, you're really paying attention to me, so I can stop crying. So basically, it's all about babies demanding as much attention as possible and caregivers giving that attention while still making sure they can do other stuff at the same time.
As I understand that this is kind of a hypothesis about how we evolved, but the researchers have some ideas on how to put it to the test. How would they do that?
Yeah, actually, the same research team is they're planning a bunch of experiments to test the validity of their theory. Some of them will be involved with actual babies, you know, singing lullabies to babies and gauging different elements of their response to the sounds. But also there are some genetic conditions out there that actually affect how a person perceives song being sung to them and infant-directed songs, which are the slower and repetitive songs that we think of as lullabies. And basically there are some conditions out there where even into adolescence and adulthood, the people with these conditions respond differently to music and to sound. So they're already doing some work with them, with these folks, and just testing their responses and seeing if it supports their theory.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting the latest in cool science news. Just talked there about lullabies. And now we're going to talk about play, Gemma, because when you look at the animal kingdom, and we think of examples of animals that seem playful, I think of things like river otters and monkeys and dogs and cats, too. But these are all mammals. It sounds as though there's new research coming in that it's not play isn't just limited to mammals anymore. We've got frolicking spiders and octopi. What's going on with these different types of animals?
Well, the interesting thing, it's really only been a decade or so that researchers have agreed that, yeah, things that are not mammals really do play. And basically, it arose when a few isolated experiments, for example, a team put these unused old pill bottles into an aquarium with octopuses and saw that the octopuses would kind of jet them back and forth and play. There was another experiment with spiders where the spiders appeared to be almost getting it on, but not quite, and they would repeat this activity over and over again. And a bunch of different experiments like that, they realized that, hey, play is not limited to mammals, so how do we know if a non-mammal is playing, and why are they playing? And that research has really only started about a decade ago.
It sounds like a lot of the research was looking at something that looked like play in a gecko or something like that,
yeah,
and trying to prove that it wasn't really play, because we didn't think that non-mammals played.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for a long time, we know it. Humans are kind of exceptionalists. We like to think, oh, we're the only ones who do this. And of course, we've broadened that a little bit to the whole mammals area, saying, oh, okay, puppies play, bear cubs play, but only mammals play. You know, it's kind of our superiority complex that we've got going on. But, you know, the amount of evidence is just overwhelming. And one huge boost to studying non-mammal play has been technology, because now researchers are able to record animals, and in the case of a turtle that was playing, they recorded him, what they thought, they weren't sure, he was kind of pushing a ball around, weren't sure what was going on, but then they sped it up to the speed that, say, a dog might play, and they're like, oh my gosh, he is playing just like a dog would play. So with a video, they're able much, much better to see that these animals are actually, you know, cavorting.
So, Gemma, what is the scientific definition of cavorting or play in this case?
Well, basically, there are a few different definitions. They agree with each other, but play is basically something that's voluntary, something that's repeated several times. It's not just a one-off. It does not have an obvious function, and it differs from regular functional behavior. And it's also, you see it in healthy animals that aren't stressed. And so those are really kind of the criteria, basically, for play, observing play. And, you know, there's some really important reasons for play. For example, one experiment done on rats shows that play actually changes the brain. It affects the development of the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for complex thoughts and regulating emotions. And actually play, episodes of play, enhanced younger rats' neuroplasticity, which is a fancy way of saying that as they got older, their brains were just more flexible. They had better, you know, reaction to their surroundings and environment and different situations as they arose, because they had this great neuroplasticity that seems to be the result of play when they were younger.
What's getting me here? I get octopus, sure. I can see an octopus playing. Geckos, okay. Yeah, turtle, slow motion play. Spiders? I think of spiders as being all business. Right? I mean, and they
you
play,
and
you're
many
telling
Americans.
Me.
Were you not listening to Gemma?
Well, I heard, but I don't know. I'm kind of baffled by the concept of a spider playing.
Well, the one that really baffled me was the experiment on wasps. Mm. These young paper wasps were noted just kind of like play fighting. Like they were biting each other, but then kind of licking each other. And, you know, kind of as you've seen two dogs kind of rolling around just having fun. But, yeah, spiders do play. And the reason we know that at least one species of spider plays is because I mentioned that they do this kind of like almost getting it on repeatedly, where they're just kind of like fooling around, if you want to say. We know it's play because if they were doing it for real, the male would have a 30% chance of getting eaten alive. So that, you know, when they're playing, they don't do that. So they're not all business all the time.
There you go. And thanks for keeping it clean there, Gemma.
I try.
The spiders. All right. Well, let's move on to swamps now. You wrote a feature this month called 20 Things You Didn't Know About Swamps. Gemma, what don't we know about swamps?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think most people just think of swamps as these, like, yucky, buggy places that you want to avoid, especially when you're, like, hiking, you know. But they're actually fascinating ecosystems. And there's so much that's cool about swamps. But even if you never go near a swamp, you should thank them, because even though they comprise about 5 to 8% of the planet's land surface, they are holding about 30% of Earth's stored carbon, which is great. They're great at carbon sequestration, which is really important in this age of climate change. And also, you know, they have a lot of other bonuses, too. Everything from in the years of the Underground Railroad, a lot of African Americans fleeing slavery actually settled in the Great Dismal Swamp on the Virginia-North Carolina border. And, you know, it was not the most pleasant place to live, but they were safe there and they were able to have, you know, full lives and actually do farming and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, the other thing about swamps is a lot of carnivorous plants actually evolved to live in a swamp and take advantage of the fact that they have really poor nutrition in the soil. And I know that sounds weird, but they actually figured out a way to adapt to living in a swamp. So there are a zillion reasons, not just 20 things you didn't know about swamps, but a zillion reasons. And they're fascinating places.
And briefly, Gemma, what makes a swamp a swamp?
What makes a swamp a swamp? Basically, swamps, mires, marshes, they are all wetlands. And wetlands is any land where the water table is at or near the surface, and the level of water saturation in the ground determines the flora and the fauna and the kind of soil that is in that ecological environment.
We'll leave it there for now. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science.